And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, live on a late Wednesday afternoon where I, regrettably, I have to take a break from watching Nikola Jokic literally play point guard in like a five-center lineup, and the bowl revolution is happening. But it has to be done, and it is time to debate the last award that I have considered for my ballot, which is now suddenly due. It's all upon us. Basketball is beginning. And welcome in one of the people's favorite guests, a guy I always love talking basketball with, of 538, Chris Herring. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Zach. How are you?
I am hanging in. Hanging in. It's all we can do these days, other than Bol Bol, who is doing apparently much better than hanging in right now for the Summer League Nuggets slash Scrimmage Nuggets slash whatever the hell we're calling this. Mr. Herring, I've brought you on. We did eons ago. We did our all-rookie teams. Do you remember the 10? Could you name right now the 10 people you actually put on your all-rookie team if I forced you to do it?
I could probably name 5 of the 10, maybe 6 off the top of my head.
Yeah, you're going to be racking your brain for players 8, 9, and 10. Cam Reddish was Cameron? No. Now we are here. The last award. For some reason, I wanted to save this for last. I think I was just putting it off because I don't know why. This award stresses me out for some reason. Sixth man of the year. I have a whole bunch of notes right here. You can see my notes. Scribbles and scrabbles everywhere. You get to pick 3 people. The official. But do you have a ballot this year?
No, I don't know if we've talked about it. I feel like I've done a few vote-related podcasts with you before. I don't vote. Maybe at some point I'll change my feelings on that. When I was at the Wall Street Journal covering the Knicks, I worked for an editor that is it's like religion to him to not vote for things. He didn't want our staff to vote on things at the time. And I go back and forth on it because I feel like I pay more attention than probably the average analyst and average writer and try to watch more basketball than most people. And so for that reason, you know, I feel like I'm informed enough to vote. But it just, I don't know. And it's not our fault, you know, but the CBA, I don't really love the idea that a lot of times stuff is based on that as far as contracts and stuff and incentives. And I know this isn't one of them that would be in there, but it just makes me a little uncomfortable.
You never know. Someone could have a sixth man of the year bonus in their contract. Yeah, that's bothersome to me. I get why some publications don't want people to vote because it could create conflicts of interest and, you know, trading favors and all that. I like to do it. It results in me getting yelled at by lots of people for about 72 straight hours. But that's fine. It's a small price to pay. Yeah. Okay, sixth man of the year. A wonky award because being a sixth man is kind of a wonky job that means different things on different teams. Typically an award that goes to scorers. You get 3 ballot spots, first, second, and third. MVP is the only one where you get top 5. Let's just start at the top. Chris Herring, who is your sixth man of the year for the 2019-2020 NBA season?
I am going to go with Montrezl Harrell. I think it's fair enough to say that it could be considered close. I wouldn't get mad if people picked my second, my second pick for it. I don't think it should probably be beyond those first 2 guys, but everybody's entitled to their opinion. But I thought Trez should have been heavily considered last year. I think it's very weird, and I think, you know, it probably goes without saying that some people will have him in competition with his teammate who won it last year and has won it a couple times now. I think that's part of what makes it strange is trying to figure out who do you consider to be more important or kind of most responsible for the success that they have. You've written about that dynamic before, but that's who I'm going to go with. I've certainly got a number of reasons for it.
Sixth man is a really weird award because it feels like it always bothered me that Andre Iguodala never won when he was with the Warriors. And I think part of it is because there's this idea that if you are coming off the bench, like the prototypical sixth man is someone who can score, is someone who can run the offense, because that's why they're the sixth man, because putting them with the starters would be redundant, and you take 2 of your starters out, your 2 best scorers or whatever, you put this guy in to make up the difference. And so part of being a sixth man is usually like kind of a centrality when you're in the game that is less impactful when the other best players on the team are in the game. And that naturally makes you gravitate away from guys who are kind of role-ish players no matter who's in the game around them. And that's what Andre was when he was with the Warriors, even though he was kind of a point guard off the bench. I also picked Montrezl Harrell. And I will ask you this. I had Harrell second last season behind Lou Williams, the teammate that you mentioned. I am a three-time Lou Williams voter in Sixth Man of the Year. So Lou Williams, number one, unblock me on Twitter. Number two, do not take me out of the rap song that you are supposedly putting me in. I'm still waiting to hear from your lawyers. I'm sorry I didn't vote for you this year.
Man, that is some Woj level sourcing right there, that you know that you're supposed to be in a song that you might not
oh,
be
he's
in.
Told, he told me. He told me. And he, it was like a whole thing. I was like, you're going to hear from my lawyer. I have one word. It's just me interspersed saying, yeah. I don't know why. I have no idea the impetus for this. No clue. So why do you think I have flip-flopped the Clippers people? Well, I may have done more than flip-flop the Clippers people, but I have Harrell over Lou this year after going the other way last year, and you do as well. Why does it feel to you that Montrezl Harrell is a more important player to the Clippers than Lou Williams this year?
Well, you hinted at it a minute ago, and it was funny because we always make a point not to talk about who we're picking and stuff like that before we actually podcast, because obviously we want it to be somewhat fresh and kind of not seemingly rehearsed for the pod. But I mean, from what you said and where I kind of agree, I think Lou Williams was going to be difficult for him to win it this year based on who the Clippers got. I mean, the Clippers were really special last year, you know, special in like a they're not going to win the title sort of way. You know, I think their shining moment last year was it the 31-point comeback that they had against the Warriors. And, you know, the Clippers had the best, I think, net rating in the league in clutch games. Lou Williams was a massive part of that. He was a massive part of that comeback. That was kind of what that team did. But when you consider their clutch lineups and their lineups that they're going to play a lot of the time, when the game is on the line, Lou Williams naturally had the ball in his hands most last season because he was kind of their go-to scorer. Now you've got two guys that kind of take precedent over him, both in terms of usage, just in terms of scenarios and stuff like that. So he doesn't have the ball in his hands most. He can certainly catch and shoot a little bit, but that's not normally what you've got him out there for. And so naturally just taking the ball out of his hands gives him fewer opportunities to really do what he's doing. Trez, on the other hand, is someone that can kind of play with everybody. Obviously plays off Lou Williams fantastically, but can play off the other guys as well. On top of that, you know, if we were having to kind of talk about an all-around player, Trez is going to beat Lou Williams 10 times out of 10 in that scenario as far as what he can bring on defense. And I thought he was actually better this year defensively than he was last year. You look at the statistics on defense, you know, when he's defending within 6 feet at the rim, he was holding shooters 10 percentage points below what they normally shoot, which, you know, puts him toward the top of the league in a statistic like that. By far the best year he's had in his career. Used to be a negative player from that standpoint when he was with the Rockets, which I don't know how much we can factor that in because it was the Rockets. But I don't know. I just felt like there were ways for him to kind of thrive in ways that Lou Williams was not often going to get a chance to do when the Clippers were healthy this year.
And yeah, it's weird. Lou Williams isn't any worse. He's the same Lou Williams he's always been. He's just less essential to their team. And in fact, the Clippers can and probably should in some circumstances build crunch time lineups that don't have Lou Williams at all, especially when they're ahead, because Lou Williams, bless his heart, is still a really bad defensive player who's a huge liability on that end. They still have to hide him. Teams are still going to hunt him every time they go down the floor. And the Clippers' defense is way worse when Lou Williams is on the floor. Trez is one of essentially two centers that the Clippers play. The other is Ivica Zubac, who had a wonderful season, plays like 17, 18 minutes a game, whatever it is. They'll play a little JaMychal Green at the five here, blah, blah, blah. Trez is, for all intents and purposes, their fourth quarter center. And I actually agree with you. I think he's only listed at 6'9". He's undersized. He gives up something on the glass. But I think this year he grinded on defense. I saw the same rim numbers you did. More than that, like, he gives you a little switchability. He can switch a bit, and he gives Doc a little bit more flexibility in how they can play defense. And I just, more than all of that, I just watched enough Clippers games this year where that team, like a lot of super talented teams, kind of strolled onto the court like, yeah, you know, we can kind of coast through this game. We got Kawhi. We got PG. We got the full crew tonight. Like, we don't really, you know, we don't really need to play that hard. And, you know, they're generally a hard-playing team. But Trez on those nights would roar down the lane, rip the freaking rim off, and trash-talk everybody in sight. And you could see the whole team wake up behind his energy and start to play. And, you know, and the numbers, to me, I think this is frankly an open and shut case. I have a big spreadsheet with all the advanced stats of, like, a ridiculous number of six-man of the year candidates. I'm totally anal. I have a list that's far too long. He's number one on that list when you factor in all the advanced numbers. He's like number two in minutes. He's on a good team. He's good on both ends of the floor. I think it's a close-ish race, but digging into it, I actually don't think it's as close as I thought it was.
So let me say one other thing, and I think this will kind of dictate my list as a whole, because I know that we, you know, we also talked about maybe listing guys that we considered that, you know, that weren't quite top three, but that we considered. As I looked through the guys I had on the list, and it's funny because I don't vote, and I just said I don't vote, but I feel like I have voter fatigue despite the fact that I don't vote. And on some level, as I looked at the guys that I have on my list, it feels like a mixture of both, you know, capable six-man candidates, but also like a mix between that and most improved. And part of the reason that I never really felt like Lou was realistically in the running for my top guy here is that everybody else improved in some way. Lou has kind of had the same numbers more or less for certainly last year. I mean, they're almost identical, you know, a couple shots less, a couple points less and stuff like that. But other than that, I mean, there were a couple guys like a Derrick Rose kind of had the same number statistically last year. And it's just kind of hard. I don't know. It could be easy, but I just feel like if the competition plays better or if your teammate in this case plays better, has better numbers. Trez, the great thing about him, like he came in the league and I think a lot of people saw him as a dunker only. This was a career low in terms of how many baskets he had assisted, a career low in terms of the percentage of his shots were dunks or dunk attempts and stuff like that. Like he was doing a little bit more. He was doing more by himself. And I kind of just feel like it put him over the top for me.
If you put a small or a crappy defender on Montrezl Harrell, if you put a small defender, he can overpower him in the post. If you put a big, slow galoot on him, he can face up, and he's got a lot of little quick, spinny moves that lead him to little flippy shots, and they go in. Like he's not a bad passer. He doesn't come off like you kind of consider him a scorer and almost selfish, but he's actually a pretty good passer. And about Lou, as you said, his numbers are he's Lou. Lou's not going to change. Lou's Lou. You know what I mean?
Which is incredible. Because how old is he now? Like he's not a young dude anymore.
But he's not young, and the off-court activities still exist. I think he's dialed them back a little bit by his own description. But, you know, one of my favorite things he told – last year I wrote a story on Lou and Montrez and their on-court and off-court relationship. And Lou told me a story about how they were in Miami. And I don't know if they were in Miami, but he said, you know, some days – sometimes I just don't tell the young players where I'm going to go out at night because they all want to come with me. And, like, they can't hang. They can't play the next day doing what I do, but I can play the next day. I was like, dude, you're such a legend. But 5.5 or something assists per game. He's always been an underrated playmaker.
Yeah.
And that gets you into the debate of like, does Lou make Trez or does Trez make Lou? Yeah. I actually think they're both good independently of each other. Trez shoots like 7 or 8 percentage points lower when Lou is not on the floor. But that split has been more dramatic even last season. So Lou's always been an underrated playmaker, but Trez to me has passed him in sort of centrality this year. A broader question for you, as you mentioned the candidates, why is it harder for me to give this award more than almost any other award except for maybe MVP? I mean, every award it's hard to give to a player on a bad team, right? Just because if a player is really good enough to win an award, his team's probably not bad. I feel it's like it's even wronger, more wrong to give a player on a bad team sixth man of the year. So my question to you is twofold, Mr. Herring. Number one, did you consider any why do you think that is? Or maybe you disagree. And did you consider any players from bad teams for this award?
Yeah, no, I did. I struggled with that. I think honestly, for me, the tendency is always to kind of look at players from good teams and basically ask, like, is this the reason the team was good, or was this the reason that the team was better than they should have been? And there were a couple of guys that I think kind of fit in that role. And then there was one that was on a team that was an absolute stinker. And I would bet, you know, if I had to, that we're probably talking about the same guy. If there was someone that you considered that I didn't quite have in my top three, but that I did consider there. But again, like, I think the guys I picked, the six, seven guys I had that I was looking at more closely, they all – three or four of them all showed really big improvements from last season too, or like notable improvements. And I think for me, that probably factors in as well, is just because, I don't know. I mean, looking at it, out of the last 10 years, seven of them have gone to Jamal Crawford or Lou Williams. And so I kind of feel like on some level, if you're, that's where I'm saying, like, maybe a voter fatigue comes in consciously, unconsciously, where it's just kind of like, at this point, if you're doing the same sort of thing, it might also show that the award is kind of catered to that exact person.
This is why I was very disappointed when Iguodala never won. Because right. I definitely voted for him at least once, if not twice. I think just once. But I wish he had won, because he breaks the mold of what this award has become. Or prime, post-prime, whatever. Still very good. Andre Iguodala broke that mold. I think one of the reasons... I don't know why. Maybe I'm being unfair. But there are two reasons. Number one, like... First of all, if your team is bad, the games just don't matter. There are no stakes at all. Like, sure. After Christmas, the games just don't matter. And there are few players that are more primed to play with a certain screw it, I'm just going to get my numbers, than like good bench players on teams. Like, those guys are just going to go get their numbers. And then there's the question of, like, well, if you're good and your team is bad, like, why aren't you starting? And sometimes there's a good answer for that question. Your coach might be dumb. Your team might be prioritizing the development of younger players ahead of you, but that I think that's part of it. But yeah, I did consider. So here's how you know I'm rusty. I realized about 15 minutes before this podcast that the guy I had in third place was not eligible for Sixth Man of the Year because he had started 23 games and had come off the bench in 21 games, and that was Norman Powell. I had Norman Powell penned 15 minutes before this podcast in third place. Wow. And I had to cross him out furiously when I realized my error. And so now I'm considering some guys on bad teams. Okay. So give me one guy on a bad team that you considered. Maybe he's on your ballot. Probably he's not.
Bertans is the first guy that came to mind for me. And again, I feel like some of that is probably a little bit of a bias toward just kind of like, this guy showed something different this year and took a big, big step forward, is going to get paid a lot of money, and deservingly so, you know, as far as just what he, I mean, he's always been a great shooter, but it's one thing to be a great shooter on four or five attempts a game from three, and then to do it from like, you know, 9 or 10 attempts from three per game, and to do it when you're shooting from 33 feet away. And this is someone who was on a bad team, you know, someone who didn't make a point to go down there to Orlando. I imagine both because of protecting his, you know, health one, but also, you know, he's got a big summer coming up, and his team realistically has no real chance to make the playoffs. But I mean, he just was fantastic all season, not much to speak of defensively. And that's something that I normally kind of have a bias for too, is like, I'm normally not going to consider someone that doesn't play much defense unless their offense is that spectacular. And you're on a bad team, it makes it a little bit tougher. But I feel like he made such a hop, skip, and jump forward offensively this year, and just showing what he could do, that he was someone that I at least considered.
He was on my short list of bad team guys as well. I did not consider him, although now maybe I have to, because I'm out. I'm leaning somewhere for spot number three, but I'm currently out a third spot. Yeah, that dude was just slinging it. The second he got on the court, he's slinging it from everywhere. He shot 42-something% on a million attempts. Washington was almost even with him on the floor.
Yeah,
all of that is offense. He, to your point, Davis Bertans did nothing to make Washington's embarrassing defense any less embarrassing. But right. Offensively, he turned them into quite a good team. Didn't make my list. Just, again, if you're coming from a bad team, just you got to have a really overwhelming case. I'll give you two guys from bad teams who I thought hard about and now am thinking hard about again because I have a gap on my ballot. One is Christian Wood of the Detroit Pistons. And two is, I think, a sneaky good candidate who his bad team was significantly less bad on both ends of the floor when he played is Mitchell Robinson. Give me your thoughts on either one of those players.
I had not thought about that. Now Christian Wood was someone that like the second half of the season in particular was just really, really impressive, I thought. Mitchell Robinson I had not considered from that standpoint. I forget sometimes that I know he's not a starter, and I guess I understand the reason he's not. I struggle with it a little bit.
No, we don't. I mean, look, I think it's been long enough that I can close my eyes and think about the 2020 Knicks and not immediately get a little nauseous because the image that comes to mind is Julius Randle driving into 14 guys and barfing up some hopeless pass to nowhere.
If he even holds on to the ball long enough to pass it before he gets stripped or just loses it.
But yeah, it's time to just unleash Mitchell Robinson. Like, it's just like it's time for it to happen. He's a good player. He needs to play through some mistakes and some fatigue and some fouls, which he reduced a little bit this year, still too high. But like, it's just time for the Knicks to play him because we can't get through this thing where it's like year five and we're playing this whole, what if Mitchell Robinson this? What if, like, it's time to find out what Mitchell Robinson is, because the evidence suggests he's going to help you. When he played, the dude shot 74%. If you break Wilt Chamberlain's record, like, it's maybe time for you to play a little bit more than Taj Gibson.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
I mean, that's the thing. And to me, for 2 years now, they've been making the argument that it's the foul trouble, and you know, we're protecting them from getting too many fouls. And like, at a certain point, particularly when they've had the seasons they've had. They're not realistically in the running for a playoff spot or anything like that. I mean, who cares? Like, if he gets in early foul trouble, if he fouls out in the third quarter, like, okay. You know, like, it's, I guess it's easier said than done, but at the same time, it's like, just kind of go crazy and see what you have there. And the funny thing to me from having covered them, I mean, they did that all the time with all sorts of guys that were not nearly as talented. Alexei Shved and other guys like that. Where they're just letting them play.
I can't believe that Alexei Shved. We can't have Alexei Shved coming up on a podcast in 2020 about the NBA. We can't. Chris, we can't.
We shouldn't. We'll put it that way. But my point is that, like, they're letting him get run and damn near triple doubles, you know, and it's just, it's people that aren't even on the roster the following year. And Mitch, they talk about like a cornerstone of sorts. And I think the talent deserves that they talk about him with that sort of potential. But like you said, at some point you have to see what's there. I didn't even think about him for a six-man candidate, but like, I think you could at least make an argument, and I think a kind of a fun argument that you know, he is good enough to be considered for it. But like you said, a bad team, it just makes it hard to even consider somebody.
But he made their team good. They're -3 with him on the floor and -9 with him on the bench. Jesus. You know who he just hired? You know who he hired as his agent, right?
I didn't.
Clutch and Rich Paul. Which when a player hires Clutch and Rich Paul, they're sending a message to their team. I'm getting serious now. Might want to play me because I'm getting serious now. Now Mitch has had a lot of agents in the last 4 years, so we'll see if that sticks. But Rich doesn't lose clients all that often. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to put Mitchell Robinson in -3, but I'm thinking hard about it. And by the way, I wanted a Raptor in – this is how rusty I am. I wanted a Raptor in the third spot because I started with Serge Ibaka, who I thought had a tremendous season. Realized 2 days ago doing research, he is not eligible because he started like too many games. Pivoted to Norm Powell. Pivoted to Norm Powell. He's barely ineligible. Like, I can't even get a Raptor on. I'm trying and I can't because they're both ineligible because of a dumb rule. Not a dumb rule, it's just a rule. Christian Wood, I got to get the numbers up in front of me. Christian Wood on the court, Detroit was plus 2 per 100 possessions. Christian Wood off the court, Detroit minus 8. So, look, I think Christian Wood can hunt some points. I don't think he brings A-plus effort on every defensive possession. Spoiler alert, few players really do, particularly young players trying to get a contract. But that was consistent all year. There was one guy, one, making a consistent, positive difference. Not even Derrick Rose. They're like dead even Rose on court, off court. One guy making a real difference in the Pistons scoring margin, and it was Christian Wood. Now, the downside is he starts off the season in a very small role when Blake's healthy and they have Andre Drummond. And then he's putting up these numbers in games that are just beyond meaningless at the end of the season. So you don't know how to deal with him versus his polar opposite of as a six-man candidate is a guy like George Hill or Dante DiVincenzo, who both average about 9 points a game but are really good players, and they both average about 9 points a game because they're on a really good team with lots of good players who can score lots of points. And so it's just your brain just sort of struggles with how to reconcile all these different player types. Did any of those guys make your ballot that I just mentioned?
Hill, so not as a top three, but Hill was like in my top five for that same reason, or like in that range for exactly that reason. A guy that, but again, like, and it's weird. I almost feel like I'm kind of very, very particular about not letting narrative get in the way of an MVP vote.
But God, I hate that word. I had an argument with Perk about this on TV yesterday talking about the MVP. And he's like, well, the narrative, this, the narrative. I'm like, Perk, maybe some voters care about the narrative. I don't care. I don't care what the narrative is. I don't care. Can LeBron please stop with this, like, oh, they said I couldn't do it in the West. They said I washed King. Who? Who said you couldn't do it in the West? Now, did we say that LeBron had the luxury of, like, loafing through the East because the East was so bad? Yes, that was factually true. Nobody was like, oh, LeBron in the West, like, he's going to be, like, the 10th best player in the West. Like, his team, okay, enough. Anyway, so continue. Narrative.
No. So my point being that it's weird because I actually feel like I, in spots, was considering narrative stuff here, which I'm probably as allergic to that as anybody because I don't really believe in it. But if there was one, and you actually mentioned it in the conversation with Perk, with Milwaukee, was the idea that, you know, is Milwaukee going to struggle without Brogdon to some extent? And I think that part of their gamble, obviously, with Milwaukee was that George Hill had more to give and would be able to play more minutes and step into that role. And DiVincenzo would be able to do the same thing. Hill, I think, led the league in three-point percentage this year. His per 100 possession numbers were great. Defensive numbers were great. You know, it was just a player where a lot of their best lineups were with George Hill in the lineup. He was someone that I did put there, like, I, you know, knowing that he wouldn't be the sixth man of the year, or if I was submitting about that he wouldn't be my guy. I did have him on my list as someone that I
great,
would probably
really
put
good
top
player.
Five.
Shot 48% from three. 48%. I think he led the league in 3-point shooting.
Yeah.
They're plus 10 with him on the floor per 100 possessions without Giannis. Those are non-Giannis minutes only.
Yep.
And just still a rock solid defensive player. You look at a guy like that who feels just like a cog in the machine versus someone like Lou Williams or the guy that I suspect we both put at number two, who for brief periods of time gets to be the machine. And it's just a hard comparison to make. And DiVincenzo, again, the Bucks so far have answered the Brogdon question emphatically. Yeah. We didn't need him. We don't need him. And the primary reasons emphatically so far is that those two guys combined are averaging like 20 a game and are really good all-around players. Mr. Herring, who is second on your sixth man of the year ballot?
Like you were saying, I think it's the guy we probably both have. It's Dennis Schroeder. I just think that if there was a real argument here between Trez and somebody else, I think it was him. Dan Devine had a really good piece in The Ringer, in which he kind of was laying out his picks for this. And I think he either had the same order or a similar order to the one we're going to have, where he basically said, look, Lou, you could give it to Lou every year if you wanted to. You could at least make an argument for him because he's a metronome as far as the consistency and stuff like that. But if you wanted to look at the numbers this year and the particularly the counting stats, but also just the efficiency numbers. Schroeder was better than he was, and he's not. I mean, I don't think Schroeder's a great defender. I think he can be at times when he wants to be and when he's motivated. But, I mean, he's more than Lou is on that side. But, you know, it was, again, part of one of the best lineups in the league, the three-man lineup that they had with him and Shea, with Chris Paul and Shea, was someone who the Thunder were in more close games than any team in the league. And he, I think, had the single best plus-minus in the league in clutch scenarios, Dennis Schroeder. So he just was someone who had, you know, basically put up starters numbers in a bench role and was consistently there for them, and I think is a reason that they're going to make the playoffs in the West.
Yeah, he's also number two on my ballot for all the reasons that you just said. You know, almost averaged 19 a game, I think, this year. 19 a game, which is the second highest mark of his career. 7%, 38% from three, 53% from 51% from two. All kind of career outliers, but I'm only looking at this season anyway. Made half of his shots in, I believe it was 24 or 47 in the last 5 minutes of close games, which is, if you played for the Thunder this year and you were shooting backwards in the last 5 minutes of close games, the ball was going to go in half the time. Yeah. Just all these guys, their clutch numbers are ridiculous.
Shea, too. Shea's numbers are insane.
Shea was just as good, and Chris Paul, on about double the attempts, was the best clutch player in the league, full stop. But, you know, Dennis Schroeder gets credit for being a big part of that. I mean, you know, Billy Donovan gets a lot of credit for leaning into that triple point guard lineup, and I think he should. But it was very obvious when you looked at this roster before the season that they were going to have to play those three guys all together because they just don't have a lot of talented perimeter players on their team. But it worked even better than I expected. I think he did recommit to defense. I mean, Dennis Schroeder was supposed to be a defense-first player when he came into the NBA, and he just stopped caring about it, and he started caring about it again. I agree with you. He kind of out-Lou-willed Lou Will. And if you're going to try to find the best prototypical sixth man in the league this year, I think it was Dennis Schroeder. Prototypical. I'm voting for Montrezl Harrell again. But that sort of perimeter gunner, I think Dennis Schroeder was just really good this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because I don't – basically, I just think that if he at least presents an alternative. I think that – six man in a lot of ways just kind of becomes a really obvious vote for a lot of people. You tend to look at the guys that score the most points off the bench and, oh, well, if there's a tiebreaker, if it's between Rose and Lou Will or, you know, Lou Will and Schroeder, who, you know, which team was better? And, you know, like how important was that one guy to his team? It kind of becomes a pseudo MVP argument within it. It's like, where did his team finish? And I think that the good thing about Schroeder is that he at least gives you that alternative. If someone is less likely to pick up on the fact that Trez might be deserving of it, that Lou Will isn't going to run away with it for that reason. At least Schroeder is giving an alternative here. And basically his efficiency numbers were better on a winning team. He took a lot of shots and, you know, again, was a key cog in one of the two, three most efficient lineups in the league all season. So I don't know. I would have been fine going with him as the guy if it weren't for Trez. I think in any case, I think he was a better pick this year than Lou Will would have been.
This is also a weird one, like to weigh how much do minutes matter, because these guys are coming off the bench. So like some of them are by definition not going to be heavy minutes players. So you're just like looking for who's awesome. But clearly there's a threshold. Like if you play 13 minutes a game, my guy Jakob Poeltl, who played 900 minutes this season, that's just not enough. Well, if you care, so some of you have to care. Schroeder played almost 2,000 minutes, which is the most of any of these guys by far. I think that should matter too. Again, on a team that, with Andre Robertson out again the entire year, we'll see if he plays in the bubble, is just short on perimeter talent to the point that they're starting Lugens Dort, who was a two-way guy before the season and played quite well for them. So I have Dennis Schroeder as well. Now I have the third spot open. Maybe I'll just go contrarian and do like a George Hill or Mitchell Robinson, someone who's sort of not a traditional sixth man type. George Hill, 1,000 minutes this year, 1,100 minutes, not very many minutes. Again, you don't know how to factor all that in. Who's third on your ballot? Because now after these first two, it's just a morass of all. It's just a blurry morass of tons of different guys.
So I don't know, and maybe it was the flip side of what I've been saying is that, you know, if I had a vote and was using my vote every year, and Lou Will kept winning it every year, I feel like on some level maybe I penalized him in the way I talk about it or think about it. So I put him at three. I would have had him as my number three pick there. The other guys that I considered for that spot were Dragic, Hill was a guy I considered, Terrence Ross, Seth Curry were guys I considered there too. But you know, Lou Will, we've already said like he just kind of does what he does, and I don't think it takes away anything. But I think we've gotten used to the fact that that's what he does. I think that he was in something of not a diminished role because his role was still big, but he wasn't going to be able to do the exact same things that he's always done, because why would you need to if you've got Kawhi and Paul George there? But, I think you could argue him for three and I wouldn't have an issue with it. I'm sure there are going to be some people that he either wins the award on their ballot or that he finishes second on a lot of people's ballots. And I won't be surprised at all when I see that. I think three is a more fitting spot for him, though.
So clearly, when I first did this exercise incorrectly, I had Lou Williams off my ballot. I have had about 15 minutes before this podcast to reconsider that, as Norman Powell, again, is ineligible. Sorry, Norm. As I look at all the names in front of me, I can see it coming down in my head to Lou Williams and Christian Wood. Christian Wood was just good this year. Just good, like really good. As much as I didn't have Lou on my first ballot, I can talk myself into it, because even on the full strength Clippers roster, Kawhi's pretty methodical with the ball. I mean, Kawhi can be explosive when he wants to be, obviously. He's pretty methodical. Paul George is a secondary ball handler. Like, he's best coming up, flying off the screen, catching on the move, and then going into his ball handling stuff. And he takes a lot more jumpers now than he used to. Pat Bev's a spot-up guy. Marcus Morris is pretty methodical and Marcus Morris-y, just working for mid-range jumpers. Lou is the ingredient that they throw in there that's like, get me some freaking north-south traction. Get me the ball from the arc into the paint, and then maybe once you're there, you'll do your little flailing to the left side, draw a foul, BS move that works every time. But get me going north-south. And when you consider that, said the importance of that to this roster, and the fact that both PG and Kawhi missed so many games and played together in relatively few games, that ingredient is even more essential than it would be on the full-strength Clippers, obviously. So I can talk myself into, and again, a 5.5 assists a game in 26 or 7 minutes is nothing to sneeze at. The guy's a good playmaker, and not just for Harrell. He's just a good playmaker overall. I can talk myself into Lou Will for third. I'm going to have to think more about it. But I'm leaning him, Christian Wood, George Hill, my poor Raptors, and then some unsung guys that we'll touch. Dragic, I came into it expecting Dragic to be higher on my list. And he had a good season, like 16 points, 5 assists, 44%, 38% from three. It's just not quite as good as the other guys.
I can understand that. I mean, I think he was someone that got asked to take that step back. And there's always a part of me, and it's hard to kind of know exactly how much is what. He's essentially kind of like a borderline starter, not in terms of the number of games he started, but obviously he'd been a starter his whole career, basically, for a big chunk of it. And then he, gets asked to come off the bench. And now it's playing against mostly second line rotations. And so, it was weird because I kind of felt like he had a really nice season from that standpoint, especially when you're looking at him as a bench guy. But how much of that is that he just is such a great fit there and is such an important player there versus the idea that like he's still kind of a starter as far as, I don't know. He's someone that I think, again, a good team, part of a good team, a key part of a good team. But yeah, I mean, I felt more strongly about somebody like George Hill than I did Dragic.
Why have neither of us, other than one aside from me, mentioned Derrick Rose? I feel like we should talk more about Derrick Rose. 18 points, 5 assists a game, 49% shooting, 54% on twos, 21.1 player efficiency rating, if you care. Did miss a bunch of games. Detroit has zero off the dribble creation without him. Why are we overlooking him? Do we need to consider him more?
I mean, I think this is he's a good example of what I was saying before in terms of, for me, this, at least in my head, being a mix between sixth man and most improved. I mean, these are the same numbers, except probably a little bit less efficient than last year that he had.
Yeah, his three-pointer fell off a cliff again. Yeah. Fell off the cliff again, yeah.
I think he's become kind of a very up-and-down shooter as far as his three-point percentage the last couple of years. But, like, he's been a lot more efficient the last couple of years than he had been earlier in his career before the injuries, as a jump shooter for the most part. He gets to the rim a ton. I feel like that's kind of his role. But as you said before with Christian Wood, he was the only guy on that team kind of really making a big net rating difference and stuff like that for them. We know Rose isn't giving you a whole lot on defense. We know a ton is being asked of him offensively. So I think for me, it was kind of like, did he improve from last season or not? And not every guy on this list did. We were just talking about how Lou Williams really hasn't. But, I think that for me, there's probably some unconscious bias with regards to, is the team winning? Did the player show a jump forward from last season? Or were they pretty much stagnant? I don't know. Like I said, I probably feel like I do have a bias, but it's because I think the award itself is kind of stagnant as far as the sort of player it goes to. The fact that Lou Will and Jamal Crawford have won it 7 out of the last 10 years, I kind of feel like I'm actively taking a role and kind of asking how much did this player improve or kind of step forward from last season. And Rose Clinton.
So I'm just laughing because another player that we haven't talked about much that fans are going to scream about is Jordan Clarkson, who's basically the same player as all these other guys that you're mentioning.
Right.
And again, like all these guys are good players. Jordan Clarkson was really good in Utah. He shot a crazy number on two-pointers and really helped their team. He played the first part of the season on an abysmal Cleveland team. All of these guys are just sort of like 90% as good as Lou Williams and Dennis Schroeder. Like, it's just like, you only get three spots, and those guys play that role a little better. So we may end up with the same ballot unless I get wild and put Christian Wood on it. I asked you to prepare three guys who aren't real candidates. They're not even like ballot spot candidates, but you just want to give them some love because you thought they did some nice things off the bench this year. They're on let's call them your long list candidates. So give me a guy or two.
Seth Curry is somebody that I would at least consider there. A really nice season with the team. I think the tough thing for him is that, as we talk about how much better or worse these guys were, their teams were when they were on the floor, the Mavs were like, on fire the whole season, regardless of who they threw out there.
That's crazy. It's crazy. At the beginning of the season, it was the Porzingis without Doncic minutes that were problematic, and by the end of the season, those minutes are outstanding.
Yeah. So no. I mean, he's a guy that I think we've all kind of wanted to see him get a slightly bigger role, and just a guy that we wanted to see get more shots, and I think it was a good fit there, and I think it's someone that. That team was not playing a whole hell of a lot of defense either, but just for the sake of it, I mean, I think he, is someone that you could consider that I knew realistically wasn't going to be a guy that was top three for me, but so, I looked at.
So one of my three give them some love guys, I cheated in a combined Seth Curry and Maxi Kleber. Both just good players. It's good players. Seth Curry's a pest, man. Physically, maybe he doesn't look like a good defensive player. Probably some matchups are going to be a problem. But he's smart, and he thinks the game – if you throw – let's put it this way. If you throw a pass that is like 10% telegraphed, he's going to figure that out and steal the ball. He's a little bit of a pest and shoots the hell out of it, obviously, like every Curry does. And Kleba is just, again, rock solid, plays a couple of different positions. He was on my love list. Give me a second love list guy.
The other guy, I mean, I think the same – ramifications as the other people I've mentioned is just Terrence Ross. I mean, I don't think that by no means was he going to win the award. By no means is he going to end up on someone's ballot that's not voting from Orlando probably. But I think, just someone that puts up numbers. And again, it's interesting. I forget about someone like Kleber because, frankly, like when's the last time this award went to someone who was a big? What, Lamar Odom, who, was a big, but not really. The last person I remember who was a big who I think was deserving to at least be really considered for it was probably Taj Gibson. And that's someone who, you know, I just feel like the award is such a prototype for guys that are like Lou Williams. And so I think Terrence Ross fits within that, but again, is not as good as those other guys. And so is not realistically going to be considered by myself, by anybody else. But statistically, you look at him, you're like, oh, I can make an argument for him. Oh, he plays on a team that doesn't have much offense. He has a much needed role there. And so he was someone else that I considered in the same way that, you know, with Rose, where you look at it and you say there aren't a whole lot of guys on that team that can really do what he's doing, but is also not making a huge, huge difference as far as, you know, I don't think is making a huge difference as far as winning and losing because of the defensive side.
Yeah, I'm a little bored of Terrence Ross. I can't put him on my love list. Just so I'm bored.
But he's, I'm bored of all these guys because it's more or less the same thing each year. And that's kind of like, I think it's unfair to feel that way, but it's kind of how I feel.
I mean, he's on my long, long, long list. 35.7% from three. If you're Terrence Ross to win Sixth Man of the Year, you got to have one of those years where you shoot 42% from three and you're just torching guys. I mean, they call him the Human Torch. That's what David Steele calls him. You can't be the Human Torch shooting 35.7% from three. You got to retire that name until you're over 40.
Right.
I'll give you a second guy on my love list.
Okay.
Mikal Bridges of the Phoenix Suns. Points a game. Not going to light anyone's world on fire. Sometimes he's just like, does he even want to shoot? Does he know that he can shoot and like points are good and points will help him earn money? But he got a little bit, he like dipped his toe into looking at the basket this year. Long is all hell on defense, can guard everybody. Smart cutter, should grow into, I mean, I think he ended up shooting it pretty bad from three this year, which is problematic, but it might even be under 30%. I'm looking it up now. 35%. Okay. Well, that helps my argument. Looks like a prototypical 3-and-D guy with a little bit of feel for how to cut, a little bit of catch and go, and make the next pass feel that I hope will come along. And just Phoenix has a positive scoring margin with him on the floor, which for a bad team, well, they weren't that bad, but they're plus two per 100 possessions with him on the floor, minus four off. Looks like he's growing into the kind of role player that just helps you win if you have the right, like if you have guys who can be centerpieces. If you don't have guys who can be centerpieces, he's useless. If you have guys who can be centerpieces, he helps you win, maybe. So he's on my love list.
That's a team where they've got so many individual talents now that, you know, and I think at moments, certainly at the beginning of the season, Phoenix was on fire. And, you know, all of a sudden we're kind of asking, is this potentially a playoff team if things kind of fall the right way, if they keep playing well, if when they reintegrate certain people into the lineup, if they gel. I think Phoenix, when you think about them, they really have to be the team that they've got so many individual parts now. It's just kind of like, can they put this together? Because I kind of like – my biggest fear now, if I'm a Phoenix fan, is that you give up on a guy because maybe you don't see him fitting with some of your other core guys or something like that, and then he goes somewhere else and he's great. And they have like two or three guys that it kind of feels like that could happen with. Maybe not great, but like that they end up being really good players, that they have a better roster fit for them, and they just end up being really good players that are there for a long time. And I don't know. He to me, and it's not, I don't think they're on the cusp of giving up on him yet, but I just feel like he's one of those guys with that sort of potential.
No, they like him still, I think. You know, and I believe other teams sniffed around a little bit at the deadline this year, which feels like 17 years ago, and didn't really get too far. Obviously, you know, he's again just a role player. He's not going to be the centerpiece of a big trade or anything. Sure. I just, someone to keep an eye on. Give me your last last love list guy.
Man, I actually think I gave them all before. It's funny. I was mentioning guys just kind of loosely. Like Bertans was someone that I mentioned who I didn't have on my ballot, but that I would have, you know, that I would have probably thrown here. But I think that the ones you threw out before, particularly Mitch, I think was a good pick for that sort of player. Someone that isn't going to be on anyone's ballot. I'd be very surprised if he ends up on someone's ballot because of some of the shortcomings he has, but also was – clearly, you know, one of the Knicks' better players and clearly someone that looked like he belonged when he was out there is going to break the damn record for field goal percentage unless something crazy happens with Rudy Gobert. I think he would
be – that's how Mitchell Robinson should introduce himself at parties. Hi, I'm Mitchell Robinson, one of the Knicks' better players.
Yeah, that's not saying much sometimes, though. You either have to come in and say I'm their best player or not mention that you play for the Knicks at all. But no, I mean, it's crazy to think about that, someone's going to break the record for field goal percentage. And, like, I didn't even think about it as far as, you know, the idea of him being a six-man candidate, but also the idea that he would have to be a six-man candidate because, like you said, he's not starting yet and certainly should have starter's minutes if not a starter's role by now. So I'll be interested. Well,
can I give you a third guy?
Sure.
On my love list? Larry Nance Jr. 10 points, 7 boards for the Cavs. Makes the right play all the time, sometimes even to his detriment. Like, he just loves to pass too much. 36% on threes in his first season, really shooting them. And just at the end of the season, for shits and giggles, started playing some small forward with Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love and Andre Drummond. And those lineups were, like, somehow wildly successful. So Larry Nance Jr., I saw you. You had a great year coming off the bench. You are on my love list. Chris Herring, let's go the other way. Who did you do research? I'm springing this on you. I'm sorry, but it just came into my head. Who did you do research on for this award? And you looked at their numbers and you looked at everything else. You're like, oh, that guy. Ooh, that didn't turn out as well as I thought it was going to turn out.
Ooh,
that guy was even worse than I thought.
I don't even know that I got to anybody. If anything, I probably was too short, where I didn't consider certain guys that, like you mentioned, where if I'd been smart, I would have given more thought. Like, I looked at the Pistons and thought about Rose, but forgot about Christian Wood and people like that. So I certainly didn't have anyone that was that bad. If I did, they were people that got sheer mentions, like a Terrence Ross, who I was never excited about the idea of going with them for. But it is funny. I did look at what you noticed with regards to Toronto, where they just were so banged up the whole year that all their guys basically had become full-time starters for at least a couple weeks, which really threw them out of the running for this, which is kind of sad on the one hand. Granted, I don't think anyone was going to win, but what I will add to what you're saying, though, is that the Larry Nance thing, I was about my last story before everything blew up in March, the Cavs were here in Chicago, and I had gone out to Cleveland and was going to kind of write about some of those wacky-ass lineups that the Cavs were playing with and all these bigs on the court at the same time and how they were trying to make it work and kind of, you know, Colin Sexton having a nice come on at the end of the season the way he did last year as well. And I was that guy asking questions, trying to ask questions about basketball as the world was about to shut down or as our country was about to shut down. And so, you know, God bless the Cavs for answering my questions with a straight face, as they've, you know, recently gotten a new coach. And also, you know, as we're trying to figure out whether there's a pandemic that's going to hit the country the way it did. But yeah, I found the Cavs to be fascinating toward the end of the year. Not just Nance, but kind of the fit with Drummond and everybody else. But
Andre Drummond being on the Cavs is one of the things that I have to remind myself almost every day, that there's something just like, there's something very drab about Andre Drummond going from the Pistons, where, like, they didn't even want him anymore. They traded him for a second round pick. It had all run its course. And then he goes to Cleveland, where it's like, what is he really doing here? Like, why? Well, I guess if it's for nothing, we'll take him. It's just very depressing. I don't like to think about Andre Drummond wearing a brown or wine or whatever the hell the colors are there. Cleveland
brown. Cavaliers. Where did you get brown from?
I don't know. They look brown on TV.
I'm interested just from the standpoint, like, Drummond, this is a weird question or like a weird way to think about it. If there were like a stat for the player that people get wrong the most as far as guessing what their age is, I probably misestimate Andre Drummond's age by the most of any player in the league.
He's
way younger than what I think he is. Like, what is he now? Like 26, 27?
At most 26.
Yeah. And like, I feel like he's been in the league for the entirety of the time I've covered it, which isn't, you know, isn't 2 years anymore. I've been covering the league now for like 8 years. And I always think he's older than he is. And so I get it from that standpoint. Like, if you're looking at an aging curve and stuff like that, he probably has a lot left to give. You know, I feel like every year now he's one of those guys that you hear about trying to add a jump shot and a three-pointer, which still feels pretty soon for that, given that he's someone that's not totally, totally consistent from the line. But I don't know. I mean, it was something where I looked at it and scratched my head the way everybody else did because they have so many bigs there. I guess it just makes sense to see what's going to happen with Kevin Love and what's going to happen with Tristan ultimately. And, you know, if he ends up
this
being...
All these names are depressing me. Just stop. It's almost dinner time. I'm getting excited to eat dinner. All of these names are depressing me.
The fact that you're seeing their uniforms in brown tells me that they really depress you. That they're like changing your vision.
Cavs need a complete stylistic overhaul. All of it. Just wrap it up. Start from scratch. Come back to me. The one guy that whose profile statistically was a little worse than I thought and was a much less serious candidate for this than I thought going in for me was Bogdan Bogdanovic in Sacramento, who before the pandemic hit was one of those free agents who was like, whoa, someone's going to pay him
right.
a lot of money. And he's like 14-3-3 on okay shooting and like doesn't play make kind of as much as you think, doesn't like do other stuff like rebounding, steals, playmaking, like just doesn't do as much stuff other than shoot it pretty well as you think he does. And I just wonder, something just isn't quite clicking there. So he was one on my list of like, oh, that's not as much of a thing as I thought. And Jeremy Grant, this is no fault of Jeremy Grant's. I thought he had a really nice season for the Nuggets, shot 40% from three. He can guard everybody. Their net rating with him on the floor is colossally bad. I don't think that's his fault. I think that's a bunch of messy roster contextual things. But when you're in the running for an award and you're an 11, 12-point-a-game scorer or whatever he is, it does make a difference. So those were the two. I believe he started at point guard for the Nuggets today in the scrimmage because they only had big men on their team. So Chris Herring, your ballot is Montrezl Harrell, Dennis Schroeder, Lou Williams. My ballot is Montrezl Harrell, Dennis Schroeder, and TBD because I'm such an idiot that I voted for an ineligible player.
This is how you finished the last voting one that we did too. When we did,
I did.
Second team rookie, you didn't have a 10th pick for that one.
But I didn't have an ineligible. It's not like I had a fourth year guy on my all rookie team. I did not have an ineligible player
for
on
a different the rookie. Reason.
This was straight up like I went to the NBA's ballot and Norm Powell wasn't there, and I was like, oh, I did something wrong. All right, Mr. Herring, be safe out there, and I hope to see you. I hope to see you in person, you know.
I don't know when that'll be. At some point, we'll all see each other again. It'll be a good day. But I appreciate you having me on, as always, and you stay safe as well.
Well, we get basketball, real games that count, seeding games. They're being dubbed in 8 days, so we'll have real basketball to analyze soon enough. I may call you back to do some of that analysis. Chris Herring, your work at 538 is essential both on the coronavirus and when you dabble in the toy department. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man. Take care.